talking about the greatness of heaven, and this morning we talked about the fact that you don't need to see that. Okay, let me try this again. There we go. Talked about the fact that heaven is great because of its residents, those who are there. We talked about the fact of its design, how it's described, the beauty of it, how that it's illuminated. There's not even a temple of God there because it is God himself that illuminates it. His glory illuminates it. That gives the light. And we talked about the fact that it's a place where God is seen. How many times did we see in places in the Bible wherein people saw the angel of God and then were petrified because they said, we've seen God, we're going to die. Well, here we can see God, we can see his face. That's how it's described in Revelation. And the last thing we talked about was that it is a dwelling place. We have a dwelling place in God's house. We have a place where we can dwell. Jesus told his disciples, I'm going to leave you. And they panicked. And Jesus says, don't worry. You know the way. You know how to get there. I go to prepare a place for you. Think about that for a moment. As if our Lord hasn't done enough. He has died upon the cross. That death in and of itself, even for a human, was humiliating. For the creator of heaven and earth, ultimately humiliating. Becoming a creature, that which he had created, becoming that and then dying, even a humiliating death for the creatures. As if that was not enough, he says, I'm going to go and now prepare a place for you. I prepared the way for you to come back, and now I'm going to prepare a place for you. And so if the Garden of Eden was beautiful, if the world after God's curse was and is beautiful that we live in now, then how beautiful heaven must be. But this evening what I want to look at is three other things. Heaven is great because it means something. It means the battle is over. It means the devil is defeated. And it means we are victorious. That's what heaven, why heaven will be great. In Revelation chapter 12, I am thankful that there were brethren that were struggling under persecution and struggling with trials. And desperately having their faith attacked. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the book of Revelation. The entire book of Revelation is written to people who are being attacked because of their faith. And they had to wonder, is it really going to be worth it? The level of animosity that we have toward us is how can this be weathered? How are we going to get through this? And that's what the book of Revelation is given to them. And in this book, it is signified various principles and various encouragements. And one of the places that I want to read to you is in Revelation chapter 12. Because herein is one of those places wherein we get an idea that when we get in heaven, we'll know that the battle is over. But really the battle will be over for us. The battle, the war, one might say, the war has long been over. The devil has long been defeated. But our personal battle with him will definitely be over when we make it to heaven. The devil has already been defeated. The last enemy that he had is death, and that's been defeated. And it will ultimately be the ultimate defeat when Jesus returns and we're all resurrected, and then there is no more death. The last thing that the devil had, he knows, has already been beaten. Look how it's described in Revelation chapter 12 as those individuals who are struggling with persecution and animosity and being already Antipas had been killed among one of the churches. Incredible persecution against them. So there was war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough. Now stop just a minute. There was a great war, but in this war, one of the sides was just not strong enough to battle and be successful. That was the devil. Just wasn't strong enough to battle the forces of God. And so as a result of that, the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who was called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down. And he who accuses them before our God day and night, and they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their life even when faced with death." It seems like there's a very quick transition from the forces of God in heaven to the devil being thrown to the earth. Like, well, that doesn't seem fair. He's thrown to the earth. That's where I am. Well, that's not fair, sending him to me. Oh, yes, but look, those who are on the earth overcome him. How do they overcome him? By the blood of the Lamb, by the word of that testimony. They did not love their life even when faced with death. Now, that was a very real situation for these people. It was a very real predicament that they were in. Do I deny the Lord? Do I deny that I know him? Do I burn a pinch of incense to the emperor? Do I engage in emperor worship? Do I compromise just a little bit for the sake of my life? Or do I go ahead and say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to burn a pinch of incense. I'm not going to engage in Roman or emperor worship. I'm not going to compromise, knowing that that's going to give my life. My life is probably over. They did not love their life even when faced with death. Why? Because they knew what was coming. They knew who they believed. And so then notice what it says in verse 12. "For this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time." This is kind of an interesting text to think about. Well, this seems like things are kind of backwards. Wouldn't you get the warning first and then get the means by which you're going to overcome second? And it's the very opposite in this passage. What you actually have is, at the end of this passage, you have, hey, the devil's coming, and he is mad because he's defeated. And there's great wrath. He is mad, he's defeated, and he knows he's only got a short time, and he's going to take as many people with him as he can. Now, you need to be ready, and here's how you can overcome. But that's not how the passage, that's not the order of the passage, is it? It's, here's how you're going to overcome. Well, what is it that I'm going to need to overcome? Why is this important? You've got an adversary that is mad and that is short-lived. You better make sure that you are where you need to be. He's already been defeated. He's already whooped. But he's mad and he's going to take it out on all of God's people that he can. Don't let it be one of you. That's why then Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, that our adversary, the devil, is like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. He wants to destroy as many people. He's been beaten. And he knows that those people who have beaten him, the angels of the Lord, there are people on the earth that are serving the God and his minions that have beaten him, and he wants to take as many as those people down as he can. You couldn't take down God. He couldn't take down Michael the archangel. He couldn't take down the forces in heaven. He couldn't take them down, but I might be able to take some down on the earth. And so I'm going to go to the earth, thrown to the earth, and he's mad and he's going to take as many down as he can. He's our adversary trying to destroy us. So that's why James says that we have to submit, therefore, to God. Why wouldn't we want to do that? Because the forces of God have defeated the forces of the devil. The war is over. And if we will submit to God and resist the devil, he will flee from you. In Ephesians chapter 6, we are given how it is that we need to submit to God. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Remember, who fought the battle? God did. Whose forces fought the devil's forces? God's forces. Who won the battle? God's forces did. So who do you need to be paying attention to? Who do you need to be making sure that you're on that side? Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God. Why? Because this armor has already defeated Satan. This is the side that you need to be on. Put on the full armor of God so that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. I want you to think about that idea of standing firm. That is giving no ground. It is not a matter of, we'll back up, we'll retreat, and then draw a line here. It's not an organized retreat. Well, I'll back up and I'll fight him here. Well, I'll back up and I'll fight him here. And eventually, I'll stand firm. It's not even going to that extent. It's standing firm right here. I'm not backing up an inch. Stand firm where you're at. And then he says, for our struggle is against flesh, is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day, and have done everything to stand firm. Stand firm, therefore, having girded your loins with truth, and having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. In addition to all, taking up the shield of faith with which you will be able to extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Think about that. Everything the devil throws at us, number one, I can stand firm. I don't have to back up and take it and then move back forward again. I can stand right here and take it. And if I've got the shield of faith, every dart that brings doubt, every kind of attack that the devil makes that would weaken my faith, this shield extinguishes it. It's gone. There's no need for me to back up. There's no need for me to yield. I can stand firm in faith. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. Well, let's go to the end of the book of Revelation. The devil has been defeated. He's been thrown down. But God's not through throwing the devil around just yet. He was thrown down to the earth, and now the devil is going to throw him in one more place. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. I want you to think about the idea of this concept of being thrown. That shows you the degree with which the devil has been defeated. God throws him to the earth, and then God throws him into the lake of fire. He's just a whipping man. God is just whipping him here, there, and yonder, throwing him over here, throwing him back over there. The concept is The devil isn't even able to put up a good defense. He isn't able to even put up a battle, a decent battle. God just throwing him all around the ring. Why is it that we would then think that the devil has anything to offer us when the devil is, or when the Lord is just whipping him as he's doing? So I want you to consider something. What does that mean then? The battle is over and the devil is defeated and we are victorious. What does that mean that I've been able to do through life, through my life? Well, here's what that means. That means that we've been able to overcome the devil's temptations. We've seen them coming. You're not going to get me there, devil. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5, you remember it's talking about the idea of marriage and depriving one another. And Paul says, stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. You're not going to get me in this situation, devil. I see the temptation coming. I know what you're going to try. You're not going to get me there. Temptations are overcome. You could put on that passage or on that slide, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, that every temptation that has been taken is common to man, and God has given us a way of escape. Everything the devil throws at us, God says, here, go out this way. Every temptation the devil will hurl at us, God says, here, escape this way. There is no checkmate in the devil's arsenal. The devil will throw it at us, and God says, here, here's how you get out of that move. Here's how you get out of that situation. Here's how you get out of that temptation. Everything the devil throws at us, God says, here's how you get out of that. He's got nothing. There is no checkmate move for the devil. In Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 and 27, it also means that we have escaped every place that the devil might entrap us. And really, that's not very different from 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Do not be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Do not give the devil an opportunity. We know those places where the devil's going to trap us in a situation or get us in a circumstance. And we know what he will do, and we know that we got to stay out of that because that's a trap of the devil. That means that we have lived our life. We might have fallen into one or two of them. We might have been tempted a time or two, but we have been faithful to God. We got out of that, and then we have lived our life overcoming the temptations and the entrapments of the devil. It means that we've overcome the stumbling blocks that have been placed in our way. In Matthew chapter 18, Jesus talks about the fact, as we talked about a couple, 3 weeks ago, the matter of stumbling blocks. But Jesus made the comment in the very first part of that verse 7. He said that, woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come. But I want to stop there for just a minute. Why is that an inevitability? It's not a matter of, well, if stumbling blocks come. Jesus says it is inevitable that things will be thrown in front of you. So I want you to stop and think about that for a minute. If I go through life thinking that the first little hiccup that I have, or the first little problem, the first little thing that gets in front of me that causes it to be difficult, I don't need to look at that and say, well, why is that happening to me? Jesus already told you it's going to be inevitable that those things are going to happen. You are going to have stumbling blocks. You're going to have things thrown in your way. That is an inevitable course of conduct, or as an inevitable course in the process of you living faithfully for the Lord, there will be stumbling blocks, and it is inevitable. Well, why is that inevitable? Well, I think you go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Remember, Jesus said, woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks. Stumbling blocks are inevitable. Well, guess who's running the world? In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul is talking about the matter of the gospel and that the gospel is being veiled. And he said, well, who's really ultimately to blame if our gospel is veiled? Even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving so that they might not see the light of the gospel, the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Big surprise. The devil is running the world. The devil is our adversary. The devil is trying to take as many people with him. He is tossing stumbling blocks in our life as fast as he can toss them. It's inevitable that that would take place. It also means that we've overcome any of the snares that would have caused some people to stumble. We've been able to overcome that in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 26. And they have come to their senses and escaped from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. The bondservant of Jesus has. We've been able to escape. We've escaped from the snares and we've stayed away from the snares. We've been able to escape the schemes of the devil in 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 11. We've seen through the disguises of the devil in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 14. And we've seen the deceptions of the devil in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9. What that means is that we have been in a battle. We have to, number one, recognize the fact that we've been in a battle. But if we make it to heaven, brethren, every temptation that we've struggled with, every entrapment that we've had to always be on the alert for, on the alert for stumbling blocks, or on the alert for the disguises and the deceptions of Satan, or the snares and the schemes of Satan, all our life we've had to be on the alert, constantly watching and vigilant and diligent. All that was worth it, because the battle's over. The devil's defeated, and we're victorious. And so I would suggest to you that's going to make heaven great. There's a third thing I would suggest to you that makes heaven great, and that is it is a reward. It's a reward. We think about rewards being something that only children have, and yet you know most companies have rewards. Even they have rewards for their employees. The bus company that I worked for years, there's a reward for not missing any routes. Monthly reward, perfect attendance, $75. There's a yearly reward if you don't miss any routes, or if you just miss two or three routes, there's a reward. Reward isn't something that's just for kids. Now, the rewards have to be age appropriate. Obviously, hey, you get a lollipop if you don't miss any routes. Well, that's obviously not going to work. It's not age appropriate. But cash money to adults talks, doesn't it? So that's an appropriate reward. What heaven is for the child of God, it is a reward for being faithful. What that means is, and what we ought to be able to ascertain, the fact that I have been faithful means that there was opportunity for me to be faithless. And that there were challenges to my maintaining my faithfulness. In Matthew chapter 25, verses 21 and 23, in the parable of the talents, this is the point that Jesus is attempting to get across, is that whatever abilities or talents that you may have been given, there's an expectation that God wants you to use them for Him. Use them wisely. Be faithful in whatever blessings that you may have, that you use them for the Lord. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verses 6 through 8, look at how Paul at the end of his life, what is Paul thinking about? He's thinking about that reward. For I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. I've fought the good fight. What is he saying? I've been faithful. And I've finished the course, and I've kept the faith. And in the future, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. I've got a reward coming. Let me tell you, I won't be the only one getting that reward. All those who follow in my footsteps and who faithfully serve the Lord, who have a love for his appearing, they too have that reward awaiting them. It's a reward for overcoming difficulties. We won't take the time to read all those passages, but in Revelation chapter 2, when he writes in Revelation 3, when he writes to the churches of Asia, they were struggling. And at the end of every one of those passages, at the end of every one of those epistles, rather, every one of those letters to each church, he says, if you overcome, if you overcome, if you overcome. The reward is stated in various terms that would be applicable to that particular situation in which they were in, maybe that particular city in which they were in. Maybe it harkens back to a description of Jesus that he gave of himself in Revelation chapter 1. But all of them are indicative of the fact that there is a fantastic reward awaiting you if you overcome the difficulties. Then I want you to notice that there is a reward. Heaven is a reward for those who have learned to serve others. Because those who have learned how to serve others have truly an understanding of the service that has been given to them, what they have received. You see that in people's actions. One of the things that the Lord stressed in the parable of the unforgiving servant was, here is a man that did not truly appreciate what he had received. And you see that in the way that he treated someone in the same situation that he had been in that owed him money. And he refused to forgive him, even though he had just been forgiven an amount that he could never have repaid. He had no understanding, no recognition or appreciation, whatever word that you want to put in there. What Jesus says in Matthew chapter 25 is the description of the judgment day. And what's amazing is that in this great division between those who are right on the right and those who are on the left, those who will hear say come, those who hear say depart, what has placed them in the various positions in reference to the Lord, what has put them in these two groups, isn't murder, lust, rape, robbery, extortion. What has placed them in these two groups is merely their capacity to serve others or their lack of a capacity. And if they couldn't serve others, God says, you don't understand what's happened for you. You have no understanding, no concept. Matthew chapter 25, verse 34, then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And here's why you're going to get it. Here's why you receive this reward. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. Naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. What great and wonderful, noble, brave, courageous deeds did these people do? They conquered an unconquerable mountain. They slayed an undefeatable force. No, that wasn't what they did. They saw somebody in need, and they said, I can take care of that. I can adjust my day to where I handle that need. I can change my schedule so that I can take care of that person who is in need. I can say, you know, I planned on doing this, but I won't do that now because this person has a need and I need to help them. I'll just have to rearrange my day. I'll have to change some things around. But taking care of that need is more important. If you don't do that, then guess what? You're going to be on the other side of the Lord with a different group. Now, this group is a little confused because they're thinking, well, we never saw you, Lord, in these situations. And so the Lord will answer them in verse 40, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. You know, when you turn down a brother who is in need, you've just turned down your Lord. When there is a need that you see that needs to be taken care of, we say, well, somebody is moving, or somebody is struggling and they can't get their lawn mowed, or somebody is sick and they need some food given to them. I just don't have time right now. My day is full. I've got this and this and this. It's got to get accomplished and it's got to get done. You've just said no to your Lord. And guess who's keeping a record of that? The Lord. And you may have gone through life and thought nothing about it. Never thought about the fact that you were being selfish and that you were not being considerate. But I'm telling you, you get to the judgment day and the Lord's going to say, go over here to the left. And you begin to look around like, well, why am I over here? Let me tell you why you're over here. You saw me naked. You saw me hungry. You saw me thirsty. And you didn't do anything. Oh, no, Lord, I never saw you. Yes, you did. Remember brother so-and-so? Remember sister so-and-so? Remember when they were sick? Remember when they were struggling? But you had too much to get done that day. That's when you saw me. You've turned down the Lord. Let me tell you, brethren, there's a lot of things that we have in our life that we are interested in, and there's nothing wrong about those things, but they can become wrong if we put them before the opportunity to serve someone else, especially the people of God. Because whether or not you want to admit it, Jesus has told us, you just put that before me. That's a problem. And so Jesus will say, why don't you stand over here on the left? And I'll get to you in a moment. Come, you blessed of my Father. You saw me here, here, and here, and you did this when you did it to my brethren. Now let me get to you. Depart from me, you worker of iniquity. Strong language for just overlooking a need and not serving others. I want you to think about the fact that I'm not suggesting that something has been earned. Nowhere in this lesson, nowhere in the text does it state that. This is just the Lord saying, I have something for you. Don't get distracted by things on this earth. I have something better for you. I want you to be faithful. I want you to serve me. And I will reward that faithful service, not perfect service, not sinless service. I will reward that faithful service with this reward. Heaven is great because it is a reward. But we need to be careful that we make sure that our reward isn't realized on earth and not in heaven. In Matthew chapter 6, this was the problem. Make sure that you do your righteousness for God, not to be seen by men. Because if you are seen by men, three times in that passage, Jesus says, you have your reward. Now, specifically, he's talking to the Pharisees. Specifically, he's talking about their praying and their fasting and their giving of alms. And he says, they do this to be seen of men. And when they are seen of men, they have their reward in full. This is the reason they're doing it. This is what they treasure. This is what they value. And so when they get seen, they've got the reward. They've got the reward that they were searching for. Now look in Matthew 6 and verse 19. On the heels of that context, Jesus says, now let me make sure that you understand, this principle doesn't just apply to praying, fasting, giving of alms. This principle of what you value and where your treasure is applies everywhere. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I don't think it's accidental that the Lord placed that principle right after talking about the condemnation of the Pharisees and where they placed their value, where they placed their reward. And they got the reward. Jesus says, if that's what you're after, if your reward can be realized here, then you're after the wrong thing. Your reward is going to have to be realized in heaven. And the final thing I want to look at this evening, and that is, heaven is great because it's finally time to rest. I mean, think about just some of the things that we've looked at in the last two slides. We've been in a battle. That's wearying. Constantly vigilant, constantly alert, always watching for the devil's temptations and the devil's snares and the devil's entrapments and the devil's deceptions. Always keeping our eyes open, never sure where it's going to come. Always being aware. And then always looking for opportunities to do good. Make sure that I'm not turning down the Lord as I turn down brethren. Make sure that I'm not so focused and so self-absorbed with myself that I miss opportunities to serve others. Always watching, always being vigilant, always watching. That gets tiring after a while, doesn't it? There's a reason the Lord said don't grow weary in well-doing, because sometimes that gets tiring. Constantly on the alert. Constantly being watchful. And that's one of the things that's going to make heaven great, is that now it's our time to rest. I've already had read in your hearing Hebrews chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. The rest of the people of God, that generation that were faithless, missed out on. The Hebrew writer says, don't follow their example. And then in Revelation chapter 14, verse 13, we have some descriptions given. I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord. How did that get accomplished? They weathered all the storms of life. They weathered all the arrows of the devil. They saw the temptations. They were alert. They were watchful for opportunities to do good. They were constantly vigilant and diligent in all that they did, adding to their faith all those things that Peter wanted them to add, that the Lord said to add. They did that, and now when they die, they can say that they have died in fellowship with the Lord, and they're blessed. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. You ever work so hard or so long and you just thought, oh man, I could just lie down for 5 minutes. That would be so sweet. I've done that. Had a few roofing projects and you work from daylight to daylight or to dusk and you're just dog tired. It's like, man, just to sit down. In a way, that's our journey sometimes in life. We work and we're diligent and we're alert. But when we finally get to that point, when we get to the end of our lives, and we die in the Lord, that's when we rest from our labors. Are you dead yet? Why are you resting? You see, sometimes we act like it's my right to rest. I'm 70 years old. No, you may not be able to do what you once did. I'm 80 years old. No, you may not be physically capable. Are you dead? Then don't rest. You still got work to do. It may not be what you could do when you were 30 or maybe when you were 40, but there's still work to be done. There's still things you can do in the service of the Lord. Resting is after you have died in the Lord. In Revelation 21 and verse 4, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. And so consider, brethren, we have finally received rest from temptation, rest from battling the devil and defending the truth and encouraging others and doing good and maintaining holiness. Physically, we have finally received rest from our ailments. As our bodies get older, they're not designed to live forever. And so we finally have rest from the ailments and the sicknesses and the pain and the difficulties. I said finally, I forgot I had this one more point I wanted to make real quick. The last thing that makes heaven great is that we've made it home. Real quick, I want to think about a couple of things. Philippians 3 and verse 20. You know that scripture? Where's our citizenship? In heaven. In heaven. That's where we belong. That's where we call home. Look in Hebrews chapter 13. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verses 12 through 14. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his blood, suffered outside the gate. So let us go to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking a city which is to come. There's a lot of individuals that have already had that mentality of looking for something else than what is here. Look in Hebrews chapter 11. All these died in faith. Stop. All who? Who are we talking about? Well, we're talking about Abel in verse 4, Enoch in verse 5, Noah in verse 7, Abraham in verse 8, Isaac and Jacob in verse 9, Sarah in verse 11. All of these that we've just talked about, they all died. But how did they die? They died in faith, looking for something in the future. That's what you've got to do, the Hebrew writer is saying. You've got to do that same thing. He says, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, for those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. Don't belong here. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they had went out, they would have had opportunity to return. If this is where they were dwelling, if this is where their thought and their treasure and their value, well, they could have gone back at any time, any moment. It's right here. They said, I don't want to go back because going back is not where I want to be. It's not where my value is. Abraham said, well, I could go back to Ur of the Chaldees whenever I want to. But God says, go here, and I'm looking for a better city. I'm going to follow where God wants me to go because I know he's going to take me to a better city. If my treasure was here on this earth, I could go back to that any time. But as it is, they desire a better country. That is a heavenly one. Ah. So where they're trying to get to is not able to be received here. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Now think about that for a minute. Those who have this perspective of there's nothing here that I want to have. There's nothing here that I want to maintain. There's nothing here that I want to keep. I'm glad to give up all of this. And those who have that perspective, God is not ashamed to be called their God. What about those who don't have that perspective? God's ashamed of us. For he has prepared a city for them. God says, I prepared this for you, but their mentality is, no, I'm fine with this over here. God says, I'm ashamed that you call me your God. How could you pick this on earth? How could you pick the temporal and the physical and deny what I have given you as we have described? How could you do that? I'm ashamed to be called your God. But those who say, no, I don't want this, Lord. I want what you've got for me. I'm looking for what you're going to provide. God said, I'm glad to be called their God. But I want you to think about something. You think about our place of birth. You think about our we think these are places home. Where's home to you? Well, maybe it might be where you were born. Oh, where's home now? Well, I live in this city, and this is my address. That's home. You go on vacation. That's great. That's fantastic, and it's wonderful. But how many times have we gone on vacation, and as soon as we step into the house, we say, boy, it's good to be home. Sure is good to be home. But here's something that I thought about when I was making this. Do I feel at home now? And I know it's dangerous to talk about feelings, but I mean, this is kind of a concept that a disposition that I have to have. There's nothing here that I want. There's nothing here that I want to stay. I want heaven. But do I ever find myself feeling like this is home? It's a little bit of a challenge, isn't it? Because after all, our home, we've never really been to, have we? And so when we think about home, it's easy for us to have feelings that kind of tug us toward home because we stay there, we live there, our daily lives are there. But that's not the way it is with heaven. Our home is a place we've never been. And so you can begin to see why the places that we are here, and this is the place that we live, it's easy for us to begin to feel at home here because this is what I've always known. And so, as I thought about that, I don't know that I've given the best few points here, but as I thought about that is, okay, well, how would I figure out if my feeling is I'm at home here? I'm fine here. I'm good here. And maybe it would be the way that I feel about what I see here. And that's where Lot comes into play. It is stated in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 7 that Lot was oppressed by the sensual conduct. As our nation gets to the place where it's going, are we oppressed by that? And do we just say, boy, I tell you what, heaven can't get here quick enough. Man, I can't leave this earth fast enough. Do we feel that? Or do we feel compelled to try to save and to try to rescue and to try to keep this country and this nation and my existence and my standard of living? Do I feel compelled to protect that? Well, that sounds like you feel at home here. In Psalm 120, there's a statement made by the psalmist says, woe to me, for I sojourn in Meshech, and I dwell among the tents of Kedar. Too long has my soul had its dwelling with those who hate peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. These places were places of desolation, far from the people of God. And the psalmist is saying, I sojourn in these places, far from where I want to be. Too long my soul has had its dwelling with those who hate peace. You ever get that feeling? My soul has been in the United States of America. Too long my soul has been dwelling in a place lacking peace, lacking morality, lacking righteousness, lacking a respect and a reverence for God. Too long my soul has been in this place. I'm ready to go home. What the psalmist writer is saying. Do I feel more comfortable with the worldly in reference to my friends? Do I feel more comfortable playing Bible games or playing worldly games? Am I unwilling to part with or give up possessions? I desperately cling. Maybe here's an opportunity to serve, but I want to hang on to that. Oh, yes, Lord, you're number one, and I want to go to heaven, and I want to have eternal life. Well, give that up. Well, I don't want to give that up. Well, then you have made your home here, then, is the problem. What was the problem with the rich young ruler? Heaven is great because we've made it home. I recognize that's a challenge to get that concept in our mind and to feel that, but maybe a couple of those things have helped us to see that. Do I view here as home, or do I long to be somewhere else? And do I look at the psalmist and say, yep, that's me. Too long I have been where God is not. I want to be where God is. Heaven is great. And the greatness of heaven is seen throughout God's word. If you're here this evening, your life is not what it needs to be. We can help you make it right. Let us know what we might do. Come forward, and together we stand and while we sing.